KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
President Obama and Governor Romney, you are both parents. Start acting like it on the climate issue.
Now that the rains are here and the colder temperatures, that brings us to native plant salvage weather.
If you're in your home or somewhere safe where you can remain, stay there. The time for relocation or evacuation is over.
Climate change, the silence that has taken place around it during this campaign season has come to light. People have noticed it. We're going to talk about maybe where there's some political compromises to be made in the months ahead. We will also talk about gardening with our gardening crew and talk about the wet weather. But let's start with an update on the storm and how it has affected people on the East Coast and also what's happening right here in terms of weather. Hurricane Sandy made this landfall last night. It's cut power for over 7 million people. Shorelines were flooded, streets, subway tunnels, residences. We got a slew of accurate and also fake photographs all over the internet, so you have to be sure you know which is which. People documenting it and also having some mischief with the documentation. Andy Hainer is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service here in Seattle. Andy Hainer, thanks for talking to us.
Good morning, Steve.
What, you know, the storm, they were calling this the perfect storm. What has happened to Sandy as it made landfall, and why has it turned into this storm that's not just cutting power for people, but dumping snow on Pennsylvania and reaching all the way into the Midwest?
Well, it started off as a hurricane, which basically means it forms over warm tropical waters, but as it moved toward the northeast, I mean, it is late October, so of course it got cold air wrapped into the center, and it basically morphed from a warm tropical type system to a more conventional winter type system as it moved into the northeast and mid-Atlantic. So, you know, now it's if you look near its center, I mean, temperatures out in Pennsylvania today are in the upper 30s and the 40s, so definitely not warm and tropical near the center now.
Did it turn when it was expected to turn onto the shoreline?
It did. Actually, the track forecasts were exceptionally good. They had Delaware, New Jersey, that stretch of the coast pinpointed. You know, the hurricane forecasters had that point pinpointed 3 to 4 days ahead of time. So this was a particularly good track forecast.
I also read that the Atlantic Ocean was a little warmer than in the past, that changed the nature of the storm. Is that true, and how did it change it?
Well, of course, the storm crossed the Gulf Stream, which is a warm conveyor belt of water coming up out of the Caribbean and off the southeast coast. And other hurricanes of the past, including, say, Hugo in 1989, which hit Charleston, South Carolina, storms have a history of strengthening as they cross the Gulf Stream on the way toward landfall on the U.S. East Coast.
So what we're getting is this big tropical storm moves in, and then you're getting this big swath of air coming down from Canada because that's what normally happens this time of year?
Yeah, of course, it's late October. It's definitely fall. And what happened was the storm basically moved into an area where you started to get temperature differences between, say, the cold over Canada and the warmth over the Atlantic Ocean. And it fed on that those temperature differences. Temperature differences are the biggest driver of weather that we have in the atmosphere. You know, the differences between the poles and the equator, and even on a warm sunny day, the difference between temperatures, say, over Puget Sound and the coolness there, and a few miles inland where it's warmer, you get sea breezes. So temperature differences, both on large scales and small scales, are the biggest driver of weather that we have in the atmosphere.
Andy Hainer, what do we expect from the storm surges at this point?
Storm surges have definitely come down. In fact, most tidal anomalies, that is just a fancy way of saying how much greater than normal the tides are running, most of those have dropped down to just about 1 or 2 feet above normal compared to, say, yesterday when on Long Island Sound and in the New York metropolitan area, tides were running 10 to 13 and 14 feet above normal. So there's still some tidal overflow going on, but But the worst is definitely behind.
And in terms of its long-term impact, people talk about a lot of money that this storm is going to cost. Is that going to be spread across that whole Mid-Atlantic region? Or, you know, what's the prognosis for this storm? Let me ask it that way.
The storm itself is going to start moving north today, later today into western New York State, but it's a much weaker storm at this point. Of course, it still has, I think by normal standards, a lot of wind and a lot of rain and obviously a lot of snow in the Appalachians. But the impacts are certainly going to be considerably less as we head later on into today. If you look locally, the Hanukkah Eve windstorm that we had back in December 2006, peak wind gust at SeaTac Airport during that storm was 69 miles an hour. In the New York metropolitan area, JFK Airport had a peak wind gust near 80. So if you compare this storm to some of our biggest local storms here, clearly Sandy wins. Our wettest day on record was October 22nd, 2003 at SeaTac when we had over 5 inches of rain. Well, the D.C. metropolitan area had about 5 to 7 inches of rain in the course of about a day and a half. So, you know, this storm, depending on where you're at, the impacts equal or exceed some of our historical storms here locally.
Annie Hain is with the National Weather Service in Seattle. You're also looking at some weather here in the Northwest. We're expecting you got some concerns over flooding on some rivers.
Yeah, we have some minor concerns over flooding. We currently have flood watches in effect in 4 different counties. Those are Mason, Whatcom, Skagit, and Snohomish. We're looking at a number of rivers, including the Skokomish, the Skagit, the Nooksack, the Skykomish, to flirt with flood stage as we get out later into today and tomorrow morning. The Skagit, for example, it's probably going to be within just a few tenths of a feet of flood stage. We're not looking at major flooding. If these rivers do exceed flood stage, it'll just be a smidge above flood stage, so it would be considered minor flooding, the type that we would normally expect to get at least a couple of times each rainy season.
How does the winter as a whole look right now for the Weather Service?
Well, you know, we're heading into an El Nino winter, which even in an El Nino winter, we'll often get wet weather in October, November, and December. But as you get out into the second half of winter, January, February, and March, it tends to lead to warmer and drier weather than normal.
Really? So
yeah.
If we do get that, that's going to have some effect on snowpack, et cetera, and
Yeah. A lot of times these El Nino winters, they'll start off with a lot of rain, November especially, which we're heading into, but then the second half of the winter tends to dry out. And yes, those winters tend to be our lower snowpack winters.
Are we on a cusp between El Nino and La Nina, or are we an El Nino winter?
It's a pretty weak El Nino. So obviously the weaker the El Nino, the weaker the less the confidence in an outlook like I just mentioned.
I see.
Yeah.
And in terms of Sandy, you know, they were calling it akin to the perfect storm, that it was going to be huge storm surges. In the end, more, 7 million people without power is a real thing, and people getting snowed on is a real thing, and people lost their lives, that's a real thing. Was it as big as those past storms that people had been comparing it to?
Yeah, this was a historical storm. This is a storm that people in the Mid-Atlantic and southern New England are going to remember for years and years to come. The perfect storm was another late October storm that was a hybrid basically between a hurricane and a more winter-like storm. But that one, it just basically clipped eastern Massachusetts and Cape Cod. This storm, it just made a direct hit, obviously on the New Jersey coast, but of course its impacts extended over a much wider area from Virginia to Massachusetts and quite a ways inland as well. So the impacts from this storm definitely exceed that of the perfect storm, especially land-based impacts.
But that's the issue, right? That it's land-based. This isn't is this necessarily a bigger storm than we've had in that area in the last 100 years?
Actually, this is. In fact, this storm brought if you just look at atmospheric pressure. it brought the lowest pressure on record north of Cape Hatteras for basically for the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast corridors. Lowest atmospheric pressure on record occurred with this storm. When it came onshore at Atlantic City, New Jersey yesterday, the minimum pressure was 946 millibars, which is definitely what you would find in a hurricane. Just for reference, the average pressure in the atmosphere around the globe is 1,013. I would the historical storms that we get here in the Northwest come with pressures that are in the 970s, and with this one, you were talking pressures down in the 940s. So yes, lowest pressure on record for the Northeast U.S.
So any theories about that? Any explanations why we've had such a super storm then right now?
Well, the lowest pressures typically come with hurricanes, and the Northeast doesn't get a direct hit from a hurricane like this very often. So that would be what I would have to say about it.
All right, we won't extrapolate onto larger questions of climate and climate change. And
yeah, there are definitely people who have more expertise in that than me.
All right. Hey, Andy Hainer, I appreciate it.
Okay, you bet, Steve.
Andy Hainer is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Seattle. We're going to talk about climate change and the campaign coming up on weekday on 94.9 KUOW, Seattle.
Good morning, it's 10:17. I'm Andy Hurst. In the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy, we're going to bring you a full hour of special coverage from the BBC World Service, broadcasting live from New York. That comes your way in less than an hour at 11 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from For Your Eyes Only in Wallingford, presenting the Fall Eyewear Collection by LaFont on Saturday, November 10th, 12 noon until 5 p.m. Located in Wallingford Center and locally owned for over 26 years. Details at foryoureyesonlyoptical.com.
Clouds and showers and 55 degrees right now in the U District, working towards a high of 56. We're expecting clouds and rain all day. Clouds and showers tonight and tomorrow as well. Tonight's low 53, tomorrow's high 57.
So now we wanted to talk a little bit about why an in-depth discussion on climate change has all but disappeared from the presidential campaign, and ask if there are any potential policies that either a President Obama or a President Romney might embrace that could move climate change action forward and get support from most people. Mark Hertzgard is a journalist. He's written about global warming for The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, Time, NPR, BBC, The Nation. He's also written a book about it. He joins us on the phone. Mark Hertzgard, thanks for talking to us.
Always good to be with you, Steve.
And Michael Schellenberger is president of the Breakthrough Institute. It's a public policy think tank in Oakland. He and his colleague Ted Norhaus co-authored Breakthrough, From the Death of Environmentalism to the Politics of Possibility. He joins us on the phone again. Michael Schellenberger, good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Hertzgard, you sent us an email. And with Hurricane Sandy about to devastate the East Coast, so you sent it a couple days ago, don't Romney and Obama look foolish for avoiding climate change issue this campaign? But, of course, we don't have a link yet between this superstorm and possible changes in patterns of weather due to climate change.
Well, that's not what the scientists are saying. There actually is a link between this superstorm and climate change. It's not entirely caused by climate change. We've obviously had hurricanes for a long time on this planet. But if you look at the work of, for example, Dr. Catherine Cahill, she's just tweeting about this morning about how climate change has made this worse in a couple of ways. One is that, we've got about a foot of sea level rise over the last century in New York City and along much of the East Coast. So already the ocean is much higher, and I don't know if you've seen the incredible images coming out of New York City, but, much of lower Manhattan under, 6 to 8 feet of floodwater last night. Tunnels in and out of the city just you know, water pouring through them, pouring into the subway stations in Hoboken and in Jersey and so forth. So that's one thing. You know, the ocean's already higher, and then you've got a storm surge on top of it. And the second point that Dr. Cahill makes is that why is that storm surge coming in so strongly? Well, the hurricane is formed, of course, by part of what forms a hurricane are the very high surface temperatures of the water in the Atlantic Ocean. The Atlantic Ocean surface temperatures are about 15% hotter than they would otherwise be because of climate change. So there is a very specific climate fingerprint on this storm, even though it is not the only reason that we're having such a storm.
I haven't heard President Obama or Mitt Romney take that up as an issue.
Not only President Obama and Romney, although you're quite right about that, Steve, they've been, I think, quite shameful in their disregard for this problem. You know, Mr. Romney, in his closing line at the Republican convention this summer, mocked the very idea of caring about climate change. You know, he mocked about President Obama saying that he would work to heal the planet and slow the rise of the oceans, which provoked Bill McKibben, the climate activist and author who's been writing about this the longest of anybody in the popular media. McKibben tweeted the other day, "Governor Romney, can you explain again what was so silly about trying to halt the rise of the oceans?" So, yes, the candidates have been silent on this, but I'm sorry to say so have our colleagues in the media. You know, there were journalists up on the stage with those candidates during the debates, although you couldn't always tell that. And, in fact, even the best one, I thought Candy Crowley did a good job in that second debate of moving the discussion along and correcting the candidates when they made misleading statements. But even she, afterwards, when she was asked, well, you know, why didn't you ask about other questions? She said, oh, yes, we had questions from, quote, you climate people, but we really thought the economy was more important. And that, I think, you know, speaks to an attitude that is shared by most of the political press in this country, most of the mainstream media, think that climate change is something of a sort of a special interest, a small-minded boutique issue almost, that doesn't really concern everyone, and that is separate from the economy. Well, you know, tell that to the insurance industry, which is now looking at least $20 billion of economic damages from this particular storm.
That's Mark Hertzgard. Now, Michael Schellenberger, you look at the science of climate change, and you have been thinking about how to tackle it. Oh, any thoughts on what we have seen in terms of how the candidates have dealt with it during this campaign?
Yeah, I think it's obviously very interesting that the candidates are saying like almost nothing about climate change at all. I mean, it's a contrast to, you know, 2008. It's a contrast, you know, I understand from other prior election campaigns where there was at least some mention of it. Certainly, you know, in 2008, Obama was running on passing basically cap and trade on climate, and also spending more on clean energy. He ran on $150 billion for clean energy. The stimulus took care of the $150 billion for clean energy. I mean, the stimulus plus, I should say, some existing policies, some of which dated back to George W. Bush. You can, depending on how you measure investments, we did a big report on it a couple of months ago with Brookings and World Resources Institute. You know, Obama, during the last, you know, during the 5 years, including the 4 years of Obama's presidency, 2012 to 2007, I think we'll have spent something like three times more on clean energy than we did in the prior 5 years. And Obama really did deliver on that. And I think it was, you know, a lot of it was done on the stimulus. A lot of it wasn't done particularly well. You want to make those investments over the long term. But I think in that sense, you have seen the candidates talk about it. I mean, whether or not the government should be making big investments in new energy sources was a hot topic at all the presidential debates, something that Obama has defended in both of his last two State of the Union addresses. You know, when he made the "you didn't build that" statement this summer, which the Republicans kind of took out of context to suggest he was taking credit for building businesses, when in fact he was saying, look, businesses depend on infrastructure, R&D investments, even the deployment tax credits that natural gas and all sorts of other energy sources get. So I think climate change policy did actually surface in this very important debate around clean energy. I think the stuff that Mark was describing, the sort of the way in which, you know, they haven't had much to say about climate change, and I think it's for the simple reason that neither of them calculate that they have a political advantage to gain from arguing about cap and trade, you know, or arguing about pricing carbon, I mean, in terms of adaptation, I think, you know, both candidates would say we ought to be doing a lot to adapt cities like New York to hurricanes. But I think what's interesting about it is just, yeah, I think climate has obviously disappeared from the public discourse, especially when you compare it to the high moments of 2006 to 2009. But I do think it came up and does come up in a sort of oblique way or a kind of a side way in this, I think, very important national conversation on clean energy, to which I think President Obama really deserves high praise from the environmental community, and an acknowledgement that really Obama, in those investments in clean energy and in making clear that what matters in terms of reducing emissions is making clean energy sources a lot better and a lot cheaper. I think we really, you know, I think people that care about global warming really owe the president, you know, their thanks for that.
You know, I was wondering, Mark Kurzgaard first, and then Michael Schellenberger, if either of you watched the Frontline documentary that John Hockenberry reported that followed the climate skeptics on their campaign to undermine support for climate change. And do you think, Mark Kurzgaard first, that that political effort is why we aren't hearing about climate change, that it has been neutralized as an issue because it's been made into a controversy?
I would say it's been politicized, yes. That is certainly true, and that was done by the so-called skeptics. I don't think they're skeptics. A genuine skeptic is open to evidence. These are not skeptics. They are hired guns. As I pointed out in the piece in Vanity Fair, what now, 6 years ago, you know, the same scientist who carried water for big tobacco in the 1970s and 80s, who said that smoking isn't necessarily what causes you cancer, a man named Frederick Seitz, he also was the same scientist in the 1990s who big oil and big coal gave $45 million to spread this kind of information. Or disinformation, actually, about climate change. And so that kind of denial machine and these climate cranks has had a huge impact to make this a political issue. And it's important to for Americans to understand that it is only in this country, only in this country, that the science of climate change is still disputed and that the issue of climate change has been politicized. If you go to our closest allies in Europe, in Britain, Germany, France, all of those countries, whether being led by a right-wing or a left-wing government, and indeed right now both Britain and Germany are led by right-wing governments, they are far, far tougher on climate issues. Nobody in the political spectrum there disputes the science of climate change. They may argue about what you do about it, how you address it, who pays for what, how fast we do it, but nobody says that the science isn't true. That is purely an American construct, and it is entirely because of big oil and big coal realizing that, you know, if we get serious about climate change, that it will mean that they will not be making as much profit as they want. It's very important to recognize this is not a technical problem. We know how to deal with climate change. It is entirely a political problem, and very specifically, a problem that is being driven by the oil and coal industries. And in that regard, yes, neither candidate thinks that it's to their advantage to talk about this, but let's draw some distinctions. The Republican Party now, basically, there's no member of Congress in the Republican Party who will say, at least in public, that man-made climate change is real and happening now. And you see that with Mr. Romney. You know, as governor of Massachusetts, he was entirely prepared to follow the science and admit that it was real. As soon as he ran for president in the Republican Party of 2012, he's become a climate denier because he knew he couldn't win otherwise. Whereas Barack Obama came to office in 2008 on his election night. I remember standing in Chicago covering his election for Vanity Fair and heard him talk about how he was going to inherit a planet in peril and he was going to do something about it. But for the last 2 years, he too has been shamefully silent on climate change. It is not enough, I differ with Michael on this, it is not enough for climate change to come up obliquely in these debates. Climate change is very probably the single greatest threat to our civilization, to our kids. I say this as a parent. It is maddening to me that these two men who want to be president, who are both parents, who have kids, and in Mr. Romney's case, grandkids, are doing nothing about a threat that the scientists have been literally tearing their hair out trying to get the politicians to pay attention. It is shameful, and hopefully this terrible storm on the East Coast, which is damaging, you know, 20 billion people, the death toll is now up to 33, and it is certain to rise further. Hopefully this storm will make a difference and finally pierce the static. But let's remember, Sandy, the word Sandy, that name Sandy is short for Cassandra. And Cassandra, of course, in Greek mythology, was the prophetess who had the ability to foresee the future, but was cursed with the fact that her warnings about the future would always be ignored. Let's not ignore this one.
Michael Schellenberger, on that note about the climate deniers, how do you view their ascendancy, and how does it affect your work at the Breakthrough Institute?
Yeah, I mean, we've been, you know, I've been looking at the way this dynamic plays out for, you know, a long time, as has Mark. And, you know, I mean, the first way that we kind of approached this was we would start looking at a lot of the public opinion research and how ordinary Americans think about climate change. You know, and the first thing we discovered was a big study commissioned by Ted Turner, in a sort of effort to help Al Gore talk about climate change in the early 2000s. In the late 1990s, but we looked at it in the early 2000s, done by Frameworks Institute. And what they found was that the linking of climate to extreme weather actually had the opposite effect that they were expecting to find, that they were hoping to find. It didn't actually make the public more supportive of the kind of climate policies that I think a lot of climate advocates want, such as cap and trade or carbon pricing or the like. You know, what they found really works is if you talk about a whole set of challenges, including climate change, but also the need for cheap, clean energy for economic and environmental reasons, that you get pretty widespread support for significant increases in federal funding for innovation. And that's what the Obama team found. That's what they did. I don't think it's fair to say that's nothing. As Mark just did, I think it's actually quite significant, and I think we need a lot more of it, and it needs to last for a much longer period than just a few years at a time. But I think what we find over and over is that when these issues are presented in such a way that actually they inspire what is really great about America, which is we're a really inventive country. We're the country of Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Edison, and we're home of the microchip, which was whose whole creation depended on the U.S. government. We invented the internet, and like it or not, we invented a whole bunch of natural gas technologies that are actually reducing U.S. emissions faster than any other country's emissions in the world. So you kind of go, well, we have a lot more global warming deniers than Europe, but we also are amazing when it comes to inventing technologies. And they're already having a big impact, including on emissions.
Right,
so I don't think we should get lost in just, you know, I think we can get really caught up in the fact that, you know, there are people that will say extreme and kind of outrageous things that are just clearly wrong, you know, that emissions don't cause warming or that warming is not something to worry about. But I do think if you really tap into what makes America great, what the American people actually want to do, you know, and what history shows actually works to reduce emissions, then I think you're actually talking about a very different framing of the challenge.
Well, let's frame it that way, Michael Schellenberger, and just give me a few moments of what you think a Republican House and maybe a Republican or a Democratic Senate and maybe a Republican presidency could do to create policies that would get us to reducing our greenhouse emissions. What are some of the ideas that you think should be pursued?
Well, it's tricky for me because I'm a lifelong Democrat, I'm not sure that, and all of my Republican friends know that. So I'm not the best person to have on your show to talk about Republican environmental strategies.
I mean those strategies that come together. I mean, where are there common points between Democrats and Republicans that can move us forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's three areas. And the first is an area that Mark and I both strongly agree on, and that's the need for adaptation. You just can't, it's common sense. The world's going to get a lot warmer. Even if we halted all emissions today, it's going to get a lot warmer. But you have, 7 billion people that want to live prosperous lives like we all enjoy with indoor plumbing and electricity, and that means that global energy consumption over the next century is going to triple or quadruple. And that means that you are going to need a lot of cheap energy, and you need a lot of cheap, clean energy so that not just for climate reasons, but also because you don't want to have completely toxic, polluted cities like you're starting to see in China. You want to have adaptation, you want to have cheap, clean energy. And I think the third thing is, you want to have a lot of, innovation. And the thing we know from time and time again throughout history, governments can accelerate technological innovation. They do it all the time. It takes a concerted effort. You got to be smart about it. You got to have the private sector intimately involved. You know, there's a whole set of lessons that have been learned about how you do it. You got to do it over a 30 and 40 year period. It doesn't happen overnight. And I think if you kind of frame it in those ways, you can start to get a lot more moderate support. Are you going to get all the global warming deniers to support that? No. Though it is a funny thing that actually, Ted and I recently came out as supportive of, research and development and innovation in advanced nuclear technologies. And this is even after Fukushima. We just kind of look at the energy math. We talk a lot about the climate math, but you look at the energy math. If you need four times as much energy between now and the end of the century, and we need a lot of it to be clean, a large amount of that is going to be nuclear. And the current designs are not very good, so we probably need better designs. But whenever we talk to conservatives and Republicans about nuclear, they love it because people are not consistent. The conservatives, nuclear is the most government-dependent energy technology. We always joke that it's kind of, the French love it. It's like kind of a socialist energy technology. But for, reasons relating to the Cold War, and to the nuclear weapons program, Republicans love nuclear. So you can start there. You can start with traditional pollution reduction, which Republican president signed into law and enforce. And then, of course, you can do adaptation because everybody wants to be more resilient to extreme weather events. And I don't think we have to, in order to get that support for those things, I don't think we have to insist that people admit that they are, that these are anthropogenic climate change rather than non-anthropogenic. We just go and do that work. So I think those are the three important elements of what we would call kind of a climate pragmatism.
And Mark Hertzgar, that's that same question to you. What's the climate pragmatism that we can achieve from your point of view in the next years?
Well, I'd love to believe what Michael just said about how the Republicans would go along with this, but it's really not what my own reporting tells me. It elides the fact that, they have drunk the Kool-Aid in the Republican Party now. Nobody there is going to admit that climate change is real. So you're not going to be able to get them to do funding for adaptation or any of the other things. It's nice to pretend that this is just a, we don't have to get into the messy politics of this. But I'm afraid we do, because the Republican Party is just very clear that they're not going to do something about this. So what can be done? I don't think you're going to see much action at the federal level if you have a President Romney. I think even with a President Obama, if the Republicans hold the House, which seems very likely, that you'll just see a continuation of what has happened over the last 4 years, which is basically to say no to everything. Where there is the light of some possible progress, I think, is at the state and local level. And you guys there in King County, Washington, are a very good example of that. You're acting and have been for 15 years now, ever since Ron Sims was running the King County executive. You've been acting to prepare for climate change and to take the threat seriously, as he says, to ask the climate question and to look at what the science says is coming for the year 2050 and then prepare for that. And I think that that's probably where most of the action will come. in the years ahead if there is still Republicans have the ability to essentially filibuster and otherwise block whatever is being done. You know, that's not to say I do want to agree with Michael about one thing, which is that it's entirely true that you can't just that in order to engage people in this narrative of climate solutions, that you've got to talk about what can be done and the solutions that are there and available and tap into American ingenuity. And I think that's one lesson that the environmental movement has finally learned. There's an important report out on this recently that I wrote about in The Nation magazine that talks about how you need a narrative on climate change that says, look, you know, we are the country that created the internet, and we did it with, and many other things, and we did it with a partnership between government and private sector. And we're Americans. There's no reason we can't do this. We can do this. But the other part of that narrative that is equally important is that you've got to let people know who is it that's the villain in the story? Who's been stopping us from doing this? And this goes back to your question, Steve, about the the denial machine. It's very important to recognize that we have been stopped from doing this by the power of big oil and big coal and the lock that corporate money has over politicians in Washington. And Americans get that, and if there is a message that says to them, we don't have to do this, these are the guys who don't want us, the Koch brothers and the Exxon Mobils, who say that we have to continue with fossil fuels. There's no way around that. No, that's not true. We need to take this future back for our kids, away from the Koch brothers. That's a narrative I think that would resonate, but it's going to take much more pushing from below and politicians at the top who feel that pressure before we're going to see the kind of progress that we need.
Might take another presidential campaign, too. All right.
Well, I suppose that's possible, but that's the problem with climate change. It's not like all these other issues where, okay, if you don't deal with it, you can come back 2 or 4 years later. The longer we don't deal with climate change, the deeper and deeper and deeper the hole is that we're digging ourselves into for our children. And so I certainly hope that we don't wait for another presidential campaign before we get serious about this.
Mark Hertzgard has written Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. He writes about global warming for New Yorker, Vanity Fair, The Nation, other publications. Michael Schellenberger is president of the Breakthrough Institute, a public policy think tank in Oakland. He and his colleague Ted Norhaus co-authored Breakthrough, From the Death of Environmentalism to the Politics of Possibility. Michael Schellenberger, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Mark Hertzgard, thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you for being with us. Now we're going to talk a little bit about gardening on Weekday on KUOW.
Good morning. It's 10:42. I'm Andy Hurst. The psychopath Hannibal Lecter in the movie Silence of the Lambs is ruthless, but he's also charming, persuasive, and highly intelligent.
First principles, Clarice. Simplicity. What needs does he serve by killing?
Cambridge psychology professor Kevin Dutton says when psychopaths don't turn violent, they can become successful CEOs or even surgeons. His latest book is called The Wisdom of Psychopaths. Kevin Dutton is our guest this afternoon at 12:20.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Dance Theater of Harlem, performing the world premiere of Far But Close and Contested Space, choreographed by Donald Byrd, November 16th and 17th at the Moore Theater. Tickets available at stgpresents.org.
We have clouds and showers, 56 degrees right now in the U District. That's today's predicted high, 56. We're expecting clouds and showers the rest of today, tonight, and tomorrow. Tonight's low reaching 53, tomorrow's high reaching 57.
Support for KUOW comes from the Snoqualmie Tribe Fund, caring about community stewardship and culture. More about the Snoqualmie Tribe and its community investments, programs, and services is at SnoqualmieTribe.com.
Now we garden with Marty Wingate, who writes about gardens and travel. And Willie Galloway, host of the gardening and cooking website DigginFood.com, Marty Wingate's at MartyWingate.com, and Greg Rayburn, who brought in a bunch of frogs today, all in his throat.
Yeah, here I have a half acre of nettles, and I didn't bother to go out and make nettle tea to help me with the head cold.
That would have been good. Greg Rayburn is the Vashon Basin Steward, works on habitat restoration, Vashon and Maury Island, works for King County and King County TV's Yard Talk. Marty Wingate has written Landscaping for Privacy, and Willie Galloway has written Grow, Cook, Eat. Hi, Willie.
Hello, good morning.
Is it raining down there in Portland town?
It sure is.
Well, that's good.
It's soggy.
Soggy. What does soggy do to your garden?
Well, you know, this morning before I came here, my chicken coop was pretty soggy in there, so my chickens were hiding under the coop. So I put some dry oak leaves in there for them to scratch around, and so it wasn't so muddy for them, and put some fresh bedding up in their coop where they sleep so that they have some dry areas, because they were looking at me like, man, what's this rain?
That was nice of you to collect some dry oak leaves. That was something you did in advance that you thought about, huh?
Yeah. I have a big collection of leaves that are dry that I've grabbed and I store in a little lean-to behind my garage so that the chickens can have some bedding throughout the year.
That's smart. What do you guys, what do you store to keep dry?
Oh, I have forest. So the forest, I can go in there and mine for big leaf maple mulch whenever I want, or woody debris. I do store chips. If I chip up branches or things like that, which are great to have on hand.
And you cover them to keep them dry? Or do you let them get wet?
No.
Because you don't have chickens.
No, I don't have chickens.
So you don't need to keep anything dry like that, just for mulch?
Correct.
How about yourself?
I like hazelnut shells on paths because that keeps you...
But you have to get those from somewhere,
muck.
Unless
yes.
You're growing a lot of hazelnuts on your acreage.
and the hazelnuts we have are stolen by the squirrels and blue jays. But that's a good way. And I try not to stomp around in the beds because it just breaks down the soil structure.
You grow hazelnuts? Do you have a hazelnut tree?
We have a native hazelnut.
This was a pretty good year, wasn't it, for getting a...
Well, you know, I think so, but of course we didn't get back until almost the middle of September, and the squirrels and the blue jays like to get them just before they're ripe, I guess. We saw husks on the ground.
They seem to be waiting a little longer this year. I think they were figuring that it was hotter, so they would get them a little riper this year,
yeah,
it seems.
Maybe so.
Do you have hazelnuts, Willie?
I don't. I don't have any nut trees.
Well, you need some. I think you should get that.
There's a lot of chestnuts in my neighborhood.
Horse chestnuts.
Yeah. The kind you can eat.
Sweet chestnuts.
That's nice. Grow a little more. They're a little more likely to grow in Portland since it's a little warmer.
I don't know. I've seen people collecting them to eat them.
Wow.
How exciting! Do you have nut trees on your?
I'm assuming they were collecting them to eat them.
Yeah.
I have lots of beaked hazelnut, and then also
the native hazelnut?
Yeah.
What's its other name? What's its Latin name?
Corylus cornuta.
Mm-hmm. Corylus cornuta.
And then I have some Gary Oaks, but they're not fruiting yet. They're still only about 7-8 feet tall.
Are the Gary Oak acorns edible?
Yeah.
You don't have to do anything special to them to
I don't
make
know
them
how
edible?
You prepare them, but they have been, they were... enjoyed by the Native Americans.
Don has lots of hazelnut shells. Are there any other uses for them, he asks?
Besides paths and mulch. They make a good mulch in pots. They're such a lovely color. Nice dark brown. They crunch really nicely when you walk on them. Nobody will ever sneak up on you in the garden when you have hazelnut shells on the path.
But if you walk around barefoot, maybe good choice.
You don't want to do that.
All right, and here's Lori. I live across the street from a community strawberry patch. It was planted last year. This year we have about four times as many plants as last year. Do we need to do anything to the plants? Cut them back? Just leave them alone? Get back to pulling out as much blackberries that we can now the ground is wet and loose?
No.
Instead of dealing with the strawberries? Are the strawberries okay, or should they do something to the strawberries? What do you say to that, Greg?
Well, if they're being productive and if they want new plants, they're probably fine. You could always mulch around them with compost. After you get the blackberry out, then go back in with some compost. It's always a good habit.
Anything you want to add to that, Marty?
No.
All right. And Willie, Do you have are you growing strawberries, Willie?
Yeah, I have strawberries. Something ate them all before. I didn't get a single strawberry because when they were still white, something came and clipped all of them off. It was frustrating. But with strawberries, you can you look up online. I'm sure Washington State University has some information about strawberry renovation. But, you know, I have a small patch, so usually I just take the old leaves and clip them off. But you know, sometimes you can mow if you have a large patch. So I would do a little research online about and if you use the keyword strawberry renovation, there'll be some information on maintenance for larger patches.
All right. Our number is 206-543-5869 for you to join us with some questions or comments, or 1-800-289-5869. With Greg Rayburn, with Willie Galloway, with Marty Wingate, who are here as they are every Tuesday to talk about gardens and gardening. Are you doing something, Marty?
I am judging at an artisan tile show this weekend. So you may not see me there, but I would urge people to go to the Center for Urban Horticulture on Friday evening from 7 to 9 or all day on Saturday from 10 to 5. Free tile show. Local artists. The theme is botanical theme. And so that's why I am one of the world would they ask me to judge?
You're a very smart person and you're very good at things.
Withy and Price are going to be there too as judges. So we'll be looking at how many needles are on that pine in the tile. You can, of course, buy things, but they'll be doing demos on Saturday. So it'll be great.
All right. Are you doing anything, Willie?
Nope. I'm not. I don't have any plans right now.
Just like the garden, you are quiescent in the winter. Is your garden, the three of you, before I go to the phones real quick, is your garden at bed now, Greg? Are you done?
No.
Now you're still going to start planting?
Well, I'm harvesting my greens, and I'm also, I still have my garlic sitting there waiting to go in the ground, so I need to get that out.
You might want to get on that at this point, huh?
Yeah.
Isn't it getting kind of wet?
No, it's like most of the tasks in my life. You know, I should have gotten to it a while ago. No, it's fine. You can plant garlic through pretty much any time.
Ah.
They just, the cloves, the longer you wait, the cloves just are smaller.
I see. Is yours?
I still have plants to put in, but I am enjoying the progression of fall color. We've mentioned fall color before, so this week fall color is the fern leaf full moon maple. I walked out the front door and it was shocking. Red, orange, glowing color. And the Fernleaf Full Moon Maple is a long name.
It is.
But its botanical name, some people shy away from. It is Acer japonicum. It's a Japanese maple, but not the usual kind. Acer japonicum aconitifolium.
Aconitifolium.
Aconitifolium, yeah.
I've had that before, and usually it clears up with some ginger tea. All right. You guys are still active out there. You're not worried about, like, planting
in the
wet?
To do.
I figured you were done by now.
Oh my gosh, no. If the soil is, as Greg has said before, if the soil is really soggy, you don't want to go in there. So after a heavy rain, we need to wait a day or so for the...
What about you, Willie? Are you doing any pruning or planting?
I'm not doing any planting right now, but I have lots of stuff that I'm still harvesting, so lots of herbs. And then I've got carrots, beets, and leeks in the ground that I've been pulling out and using. And I just saw I use carrot tops a lot in the kitchen, and I just saw a great recipe yesterday on this website called Tasting Table for roasted carrots, and then they made a pesto with the carrot tops. So they blanched the carrot tops in boiling water, and then they made pesto with roasted almonds and olive oil and garlic and cheese. And I thought, I think I'm going to try that this week because I have carrots with tops in my garden.
I did not know that you could do that with carrot tops.
Yes, it's one of those good extra edibles that you get to eat if you grow your own.
Do you need to blanch them for a particular reason? I mean, does it change their texture or their taste?
You know, they have a little bit of a funny texture. I've made pesto with carrot tops before and not blanched them, and it was fine. Because, you know, I think if you're pulverizing stuff in a food processor. But, you know, they can have a little bit of a bitter flavor. They sort of taste like parsley with the carrot undertone. And so blanching them probably knocks down any bitterness and also just makes them a little bit easier to blend up in the pesto.
Parsley with a carrot undertone and a nice white wine. Ted is in Silverdale. Hi, Ted. How are you? Oh, Ted went away. Ted left us. VJ is in Sammamish. Hi, VJ.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
So I had a question for the gardening experts. I started an organic kind of garden, a raised garden, and I put down some broccoli and cauliflower seeds about 3-4 weeks ago, and they're kind of sprouting right now. So I was just wanting to find out, would they, in fact, flower and, you know, give me anything to eat, or is it kind of lost cause right now?
Is VJ going to get some broccoli? Willie, what do you think?
Well, he got it into the ground a little too late. If you're going to plant broccoli by seed in the garden, you'll probably want to do that in like July, actually. So, you know, I would leave them if they sprouted. I mean, nothing hurts to just leave it there and see, maybe in spring they'll grow and something will happen. If not, you can eat broccoli and cauliflower leaves. Just blanch them and use them like you would cabbage. So I say wait and see.
All right. Wait and see. John's in Olympia. Some chestnut trees in Olympia, huh, John?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I think that Michael Dolan, the owner of Burnt Ridge Nursery, should be nominated as a state treasurer.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. He has actually identified and rescued some chestnut trees in the Olympia area that were grown from cuttings brought across on the Oregon Trail under the seat of covered wagons. And he has them available in his catalog. And he's just a fountain of knowledge about fruiting trees and nut trees, et cetera. There's actually a couple famous trees in the Tumwater and Olympia area that one in particular, the homeowner actually puts netting that funnels the nuts that fall towards the sidewalk so people can glean them more easily.
Oh, that's great. Do you know this? Yeah.
I don't, but I would like to know more. That's fabulous because, of course, the chestnut trees were almost wiped out by chestnut blight in the 20th century. So it's great that there are still some good ones around. You can see old chestnut trees resprouting some places along in the eastern half of the country.
And trying to come back?
Yeah, they don't look like fabulous big trees anymore, but they're still around.
All right, John, thanks for that. And Ted in Silverdale, you got a question about moss, huh? Ted? I don't know. Ted, we're just not agreeing with Ted. Ted and I don't, he wants to know how to grow moss. How does he grow moss? He has some growing under
still.
He has some growing under his blueberries. I guess he wants to encourage it.
Oh, well, usually it's a matter of keeping down the competition. So keeping the grass and other weeds out of it really helps. But usually it does a pretty good job on its own. You can there's recipes for putting it in a blender with buttermilk and whirring it up. And, you know,
yum.
Great for a cocktail party. Or you can just spread it out on the ground, and that actually helps.
I've done that thing with the buttermilk.
Have you?
Yeah, it worked.
Excellent.
You told me that a long time ago, and I tried it, or you did. All right, last quick question here from Tom. I've been harvesting a lot of fall coal crops. I was wondering if it's best to simply cut them at ground level and let the roots decay, or if I should remove the roots. What do you think, Willie? He's worried about club root.
I'd probably pull the roots out. Brassicas, just coal crops, tend to have a lot of disease and pest problems, so might as well just take them out of the garden totally once you're done harvesting.
Take them away. Willie Galloway is the
host. If you go ahead. If you see club root, do not put it in your compost. Put it in your yard waste bin or throw it away.
And club root looks like a big old gnarly root on the brassica.
Yeah.
All right. Willie Galloway is host of the gardening and cooking website, digginfood.com. She's written Grow, Cook, Eat. Marty Wingate writes about gardens and travel at martywingate.com, and her book is Landscaping for Privacy, and she's working on a novel, The Garden Plot,
indeed.
And the second one, right?
The third one.
Third one.
Voyage of Discovery.
We'll get them out.
Okay.
I'm waiting for them. And Greg Rayburn and I are working on our books and our minds.
Yes.
And he is the Vashon Basin Steward who works at Habitat Restoration, Salmon Recover on Vashon and Maury Island. Jason Pagano, Brian Buckaloo, Amin Al-Sadeh, Alexander Garrettin, Danielle Anthony help us produce Daniel Anthony Goodwin, help us produce our show. And Katie Sewell's producer. I'm Steve Scherr. Have a good day.
Good morning. It's 10:59. In the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy, we're going to bring you a full hour of special coverage from the BBC World Service, broadcasting live from New York. That's coming up next. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from the Evergreen State College, a four-year public college in Olympia, where students are challenged to unlock their passion for learning in small, theme-based classes. Information available from representatives at fall college fairs and online at evergreen.edu/welcome.
94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from TherapySearch.net, a place to turn when making the important decision of choosing a counselor, providing information to help those seeking counseling make educated choices and find psychotherapists who meet their needs.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.